We have come in our study of the paragraph that starts in verse 16 of chapter 5 and goes, I'm assuming, down through the end of verse 26. We've come to the point where Paul is going to address the obvious differences between the flesh and the spirit. He said in our studies so far that if we walk by the Spirit, we'll be involved in a clash of agendas because the flesh has its agenda and the Spirit has his, and the opposition that exists is within us in these bodies, creating a tension and strife within us. And sometimes we feel it and sometimes we don't, but the end result is we're not able to do what we want to do. The bottom line, I think, in Romans especially, is that you're not ever free. You're a slave to somebody. And you're either going to be a slave of sin or you're a slave of God, because that's the way we're created. So we end up not being able to do the things we please, but if we're led by the Spirit, we're not under the law. It's a whole different mindset. So this evening we're going to start in verse 19. Actually, I'm going to speed up a little bit, probably do the first two words also in verse 20, because the five things that are listed in verses 19 and the first part of 20 seem to all fit together, so we're going to deal with them as a unit, and then we'll get into the other issues next time, Lord willing. Verse 19 says that the deeds of the flesh are evident, made manifest, clearly visible, easily discerned. And then he starts listing them. Immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, and so on, so on, so on, so on. This evening we're going to look at the first five, the immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery thing, because they seem to all have one thing in common, and that is the misuse of the body in terms of sexual things. That may not be as obvious under the idolatry and sorcery thing, but I think I can, I can at least show you why I think they are. Whether I can persuade you they are or not is another point. But it's without any debate outside this room anyway, or inside this room anyway, that we live in a culture that's drowning in sexual perversion. It's so, it's just everywhere. You can't escape it. And when the culture is already pervasively polluted that way, it's a shock and an affront to the participants in this culture to be told that God's attitude towards sexual misconduct is negative in the extreme. They don't want to hear it, and they won't hear it. They won't listen. It's a shock to them. It's an affront to them. And they have all kinds of words they'll call you if you say it. But the fact is, when you read the scriptures about God's attitude towards sexual misconduct, you read about horrible things in terms of eternal death. In the descriptions that the New Testament gave of eternal death is fire, weeping, and gnashing of teeth. And almost universally, people are more afraid of the fire than they are the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Because the fire is a physical thing, and the burning fiery reality, the smoke of their torment ascending forever up in front of the throne, as the book of Revelation presents it, produces this horrible reality of a constant burning of something that has to do with the physical. I mean, you know, Dante's Inferno was a very offensive picture for a culture like ours. But back when he painted that, that's the way they thought. And Jonathan Edwards preached the sinners in the hands of an angry God with people dangling over the fires of hell by a spiderweb thread. You know, that was the imagery that he used to terrify them into repentance or whatever. But the fact is, God presents that picture, a pain of eternal burning, and it puts people off in our culture in a maximum kind of way, because they just can't imagine the culture being that distorted in terms of the way God sees things. But if you were to read, for example, Genesis 9, where Noah comes off the ark and they have their harvest, they make their wine, and it ferments, and he drinks too much, and he gets drunk, and he's in his tent, and he's apparently completely disrobed in his drunkenness, and his son, Ham, goes into the tent, sees him naked, and comes back out and tells his brothers, and Shem and Japheth take a blanket and they put it on their shoulders and they walk into the tent backwards and they lay this blanket over their dad so that they won't see him naked. And in our culture that makes absolutely no sense. None. But it is out of Ham's activity that Noah pronounces, "Cursed be Canaan," the offspring of Ham. And the curse that comes upon the Canaanites is directly tied to the attitude he evidenced by seeing his dad without any clothes on. And to people in this culture, to even suggest that there was that level of conscientiousness that they would walk backwards with a blanket and lay it over their dad without ever looking at him. I mean, you know, we have such an exposure to nakedness in our culture that it's just, you just can't even imagine it. But that tells you that back then, this whole concept of sexual issues was way more significant than we ever give it any thought. And today, if you say anything about that, the first thing they'll tell you is that you're a prude or that you've got these Puritan hang-ups. That's the accusation that will come sooner or later if you say anything. And yet, those kinds of charges that you're being prudish or whatever are just really the reaction of sexually promiscuous people who object to any restraint on their sexual licentiousness. It's just their way of making themselves feel good about it. But also, because we have been inundated in this culture, Paul, apparently, even in the first century, felt like the most obvious evidence of the flesh being in control is going to show up in immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, and sorcery. These are the works of the flesh that are most manifest. And they all have to do with the misuse of the physical body by the people who are dwelling in them. In a contrasting kind of way, it's interesting that in the New Testament, the salvation that is participated in by believers, the salvation of the soul and the spirit of man, is extended into the present time by way of the first fruits of the Spirit. But the physical body is left completely unregenerated. It's in a completely physical sense. It's unaffected by the salvation that God promises until the death and the resurrection of the body. Paul says that this body has been consigned to corruption and God hasn't done anything to keep that from happening. It's going to go down until it kills it, until death occurs. The only solution is for death to occur. Then resurrection can correct all of the issues. That has to mean something about how God views our physical bodies. And the question is, what is the significance of Paul's focus on sexual sins in this context as his first rattle-out-of-the-box contrast between the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit? The answer has to have something to do with how manifest the works of the flesh are. And just as clearly as it can possibly be, that answer has to have something to do with God's attitude toward, obviously, physical evil. It's everywhere. Can't escape it. In our culture, I think a burqa is probably overkill in the opposite direction. But it's no surprise to me that Muslims are offended by the licentious, flagrant sexuality that's prominent in American culture. So, first thing I want to ask is, why are the deeds of the flesh that are evident that have to do with, and by the way, the King James has adultery in there, but that doesn't have this textual support that perhaps needs to be there. So the New American Standard has immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery. There are 15 things, I think, listed all together. But these first five, the question is, what is the deal? Why are they evil? What is the reason that God says, these things are wicked? These things are going to create a burning in hell. These things are going to be the kind of thing that causes people who are sensitive to them to be very careful about how they act, like Shem and Japheth did. In the Old Testament, sexual sins were almost always capital crimes. Adultery was punishable by death. Bestiality was punishable by death. Most of the sexual issues in the Old Testament were capital crimes. And capital crimes mean that you kill people over them. It was written into the Mosaic Code that if somebody was guilty of this stuff, kill them. And the question is, why? I mean, granted, we live in a culture that's anesthetized to the idea that sexual stuff is all that bad. Because that's where we go automatically. That's where the culture automatically goes there. Everything is oriented toward sexual misbehavior. And I don't believe that God gave the capital crime issues in the Law of Moses so much to get rid of people who committed the sin. I don't think he gave those laws just to get rid of people. I think he gave those laws to intensify the gravity of the illicit reality of the activity. And I say that because even God didn't enforce the Mosaic Code when David committed adultery with Bathsheba. By law, David should have been killed. So should Bathsheba. They should have been put to death. They should have been stoned to death. That's what the Mosaic Law called for. And the fact that God didn't enforce it with David looks like favoritism, special case. This is David's own, you know, he's the king, you can't. That's not God's character. He doesn't play favorites. And it's not about the fact that David was the king, so he got special favor. That's not the issue. According to Paul's concept of the law his New Testament concept of the law was that God never did give it to regulate behavior. He gave it to reveal the nature of sin. And given that, God doesn't have to execute the penalties. He's free to be gracious because Christ is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. He doesn't have to be just. He can be gracious because His Son's gonna, and has by now, paid the price so that He's free to be gracious. So He can be gracious. He doesn't have to execute the law. But the impact of the law still needs to stand. And that impact is the gravity of the problem. It was a heinous thing for David to do what he did with Uriah's wife. It was a horrible thing. And it's not made less horrible by the fact that so many so-called evangelical preachers end up doing the same kind of thing. In and out, all the time, you run into this. It just blows your mind. But still heinous. The issue is that even though there is and was forgiveness, that forgiveness is not supposed to be a diminishing of the gravity of the evil. It's not supposed to be the kind of thing where, well, that's forgivable, so it's not a big deal. You know, the big deal is when it's unforgivable. Well, there's only one unforgivable sin, according to Jesus' own teaching. So that would only mean that there's only one bad thing. Everything else is okay because it's forgivable. That's not true. The biblical picture is there is nothing that is okay if it's evil. That's what eternal Gehenna says. You commit one sin, and eternal death is your just due. That's what justice will do. It's a horrible thing. So when we're talking about the reality of the evil. The Old Testament starts with this reality that sexual sins often are capital crimes. But that raises the question, why? Why is sexual misconduct considered by God to be such a high level of wickedness? Because there are a lot of other things in the Bible that you would think. I mean, frankly, from our cultural setting, I would much rather stone to death some guy that beats his wife than an adulterer. I mean, I would. I'd rather take the guy that beats his wife out and beat him until he knows what it's like. But in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, there's nothing said about a husband mistreating his wife physically, as far as I know. It's almost like men never did that until they were Americans in the 20th century. Hey, men have always been abusive, and yet there's nothing said about that. But if it's sexual, even with the Sodom and Gomorrah stuff, you know, you try to minimize the sexual stuff and say, well, it was their attitude. Nah, it was their sexual misbehavior. So, we have to ask the question, what is it about sexual misconduct that is considered such a high level of wickedness by God? And we're not going to find the answer here in Galatians 5 because it's a grocery list. So, I'm going to go outside of Galatians and y'all can just stick up your radar and say, ooh, I don't know if I can buy this or not, but that's okay. That's what it's for. Radar comes up. So you go check it out yourself. When Paul confronted the Corinthians, because the Corinthians were an arrogant group, the two letters to the Corinthians were written by Paul to deal with the basic confrontation that Christianity has with the human nature, and that is the arrogance. The Corinthians were so arrogant, that they thought it was loving to put up with a guy who was living with his father's wife. That is arrogance out the... That's how bad it was. And in his confrontation with these believers who were really wrapped up in their arrogance, he claimed that at least one of the reasons that sexual misconduct is as bad as it is to be found in the fact, as he reveals it in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 18 and 19, that the physical body was created by God to be and intended for being the primary tool of the indwelling spirit, so that the works of the body were a manifestation of the spirit within. That's what the body was designed by God to be. And he questions the Corinthians by saying, don't you know that your body is the temple of the Spirit of God who dwells in you? Ah! He says, your behavior is so contradictory to the reality of God placing His Spirit in your body, because that Spirit in that body is supposed to produce this kind of thing, and the body is being allowed to do these things, and it's a total contradiction of everything you stand for as a believer. Total contradiction. So, his argument is that the body was intended by God to be a tool of revelation, by manifestation of the invisible realities that are internalized, so that you could tell what a person's spirit was like by watching what his body did. And that's the whole issue of the incarnation. Jesus came to give us a clearer picture of what God is actually like, even though you can say it in words. When you see it in behavior, it makes a different and more potent impact on you. So that Jesus came to make manifest the reality of God by becoming flesh, taking on a body, filled with the Spirit of God, and making manifest the reality of the truth about God. That's what the body was designed to do. And that would mean several things. First of all, it would mean that any corruption of the works of the body would be a direct testimony to the corruption of the spirit within that body. If the body is doing things it ought not to do, that tells you something about the spirit that's dwelling in it. And if it tells you that about the spirit that dwells in it, what it's doing is it's glorifying this inner spirit. The actions of the body make manifest the true character of the inner spirit. That's what it means to glorify. Make manifest, open the understanding to the clarity. And of course, all through the first 4,000 years of human history, the testimony of the body was the corruption of the spirit of man is awesome and horrible because the behavior is that way. That's why God gave the law to say, here's what ought to be, here's what is. Compare them. Tell me what you think about the spirit of man given this contrast. Because the end result's supposed to be, oh man, we're lost. There is no hope for us in ourselves. There's nothing that we can do to recommend ourselves to God in His truthfulness and His holiness and so on. It's hopeless. That's the point. Paul said the law was given to drive that point deeply into the psyche of the person who's willing to compare what ought to be with what is, so that God can change it. That means then that the works of the body are a direct testimony to the reality of the spirit, the character of the spirit that's in that body. And that means that it was no accident that Jesus told his disciples, who he had given an agenda, make the disciples of all nations, don't even start. You stay in Jerusalem until you get a spiritual presence in your physical body that will empower you to be my witnesses. Don't even start to try to pursue the agenda until you're qualified. And you're not going to be qualified till you receive what was promised by the Father, and that is the Spirit of Jesus dwelling in your physical body. Because if the Spirit of Jesus is in your physical body, at least then the physical body has some capacity to tell the truth to the world. And Jesus gave his disciples the commission to make disciples and teach them all the stuff that Jesus taught. But without a visible demonstration of the reality of it, it ain't going to work. So, don't even try it until it can work. And that means the Spirit of God dwells in the body. People can see the truth. So, if that's the reason why God gave the Spirit of God to us, because our spirit was corrupted, then the work of the Holy Spirit can be compromised by any overt work of the body that doesn't square with the glory of God. So, the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these. Immorality does not square with the character of God. Impurity does not square with the character of God. Sensuality does not square with the character of God. Idolatry does not square. Sorcery does not square. Okay, what happens if a believer is allowing the flesh to produce these things that don't add up to the presence of the Spirit of God in his body? Well, it corrupts everything he says to anybody and everybody. And so you end up with these statements like, well, if that's what a Christian is, I ain't interested. Well, it's a convenient excuse, but the fact is, that ain't what a Christian is. It's not supposed to be this way. Supposed to be walking by the Spirit, but you're not. So the works of the flesh become manifest, and when you get into this manifest distortions, what you end up doing is corrupting the picture that God intended to give to those who observe your physical body, and they are led into blasphemous theology. Check out Jude 4, for example. There's only one chapter in Jude, so it's Jude 4. What happens in Jude 4? They turn the grace of God into lasciviousness. What does that mean? It means they take the glory of God that's called grace and they turn it into an excuse for all kinds of sexual immorality. Well, is that what God's really about? Absolutely not. Well, then can the grace of God be used in that direction? Absolutely not. Not legitimately. So who are these people who are turning grace into an excuse for this kind of immoral behavior? Well, obviously, they're false brethren. And what's the theology that comes out of a person who claims he's in touch with God and he's living
a sexually immoral life, it's obvious. Well, the testimony is, well, this is the kind of God that runs this universe. I'm picking on a group here when I say this, but the fact is, when you have a homosexual church that is meeting in the name of Jesus, and they're actively practicing their perversion, they are presenting a God to the world that has a certain character. And Paul would say, yeah, they are, but it's a blasphemy. It's a misrepresentation of God. And what happens when you have a misrepresentation of God? Well, if it's believed, what happens? Well, people suffer the consequences of what they believe, because what they believe governs their future. So if you have observers observing Christians' behavior, physical body behavior, if you have observers observing that, and the words of the mouth are one thing, but the behavior is dominant, because it always is, then the deeds of the body are compromising the truth of the gospel, and anybody who observes the contradiction is going to be destroyed by the false doctrine. That's what Galatians is about. Galatians is about people who are presenting a false gospel. It's an untrue God. It's confidence in the wrong deity. And confidence in the wrong deity ends up in spiritual death forever. So the people are being destroyed by believing in the false presentation that is caused by the behavior of the body. I think this is the fundamental issue of why sexual misconduct is such a high-level wicked behavior, because of the impact it has on people who don't understand God, don't know Him, don't have a snowball's chance in the hot place of ever being delivered from their evil unless somebody tells them the truth. And the telling has to be, according to Paul's letter to Philippians or the Thessalonians, that our gospel came to you not in word only, but also in the power of the Spirit of God. What's that mean? Boiled down to this: we told you the truth and we lived it. Bang! It made a huge impact on the people who heard it and saw it. But what if the words are right and the behavior is wrong? Well, what are people going to believe? The words or the behavior? Well, obviously. They're going to say, well, the words can't be true. He doesn't even believe that. If he believed that, he wouldn't be acting like that. That's the automatic and legitimate conclusion for misconduct. The Bible says faith produces corresponding behavior. So if the behavior is contradictory, then you know the words are not being believed. And if you don't even believe them yourself, how can you expect anybody else to believe them? That would be the argument. So I really do think that the reason why sexual misconduct is the big bad thing that it is boils down fundamentally to people's eternal destinies being influenced by a false gospel being produced by behavior. A gospel that says it's okay to act like this because God is okay with it. He is not. We see reinforcement of this in the letter to the Corinthians by Paul, because he told them to turn the worst offender in terms of the sexual perversion thing, the guy who was living with his father's wife, he told them to turn him over to Satan for the destruction of his body. In other words, when you come together and my spirit with you, you turn this guy over to the devil, the Satan, and let the devil have him physically. You think the devil will take him? You bet. What's he going to do with him? Kill him. Because Satan would have killed Job in a New York second if God had allowed it. So you give, if the church, with God's agreement, gives somebody over to Satan, he'll take them and kill them. And that means then that there still remains a capital character to the offense. We're not involved in executing a capital crime issue with sexual immorality. We don't advocate stoning people who commit adultery or fornication or immorality or whatever. But God still does. And especially if it's a believer who's just really out to lunch in terms of what he's allowing in his body. If it's bad enough, he'll turn him over to the devil. He'll die. The capital crime issue's still in there. And the point is this. Sexual misconduct is a gross evil because of its blasphemous impact on those who witness it. It makes them think wrongly about God. And thinking wrongly about God has all kinds of attendant consequences on the thinkers. So, the evil of it is in a relational universe where love is supposed to be the main thing. The grossest evil is when hate gets the upper hand and destroys. And that's what sexual immorality does. It allows people's thinking to be corrupted so that they're destroyed by it. So that's the reason I think that there is a first rattle out of the box kind of emphasis on sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, and sorcery. Now, let me just real quickly point out what these things are. The word immorality is a translational word that basically means sexual misconduct of all kinds. So adultery is a form of it. Bestiality is a form of it. Homosexuality is a form of it. So the word that's translated immorality, typically in the King James, fornication, but the word means that you're out of line sexually, doing something you ought not to be doing. The word impurity is a word that comes from the Old Testament concept of being clean, and the whole issue of clean has to do with whether or not you're communicating bacteria to death to somebody. You're unclean if your physical condition can cause somebody else to get sick and perhaps die, because you communicate that uncleanness to them. Lepers were unclean because leprosy had no solution. You communicate your leprosy to somebody else and they're going to die from it, just like you're going to die from it. There are all kinds of things in the scriptures like that. So the uncleanness issue is an issue of sexual misconduct that can introduce death to the participants. And that's exactly what we see in our culture. There are all kinds of diseases and consequences for sexual misconduct that ultimately are destructive to the life of the individual. That's the word uncleanness. The word translated sensuality is probably more like wantonness or the lack of any kind of control. It indicates a fixation on something that people just go overboard with. Just go overboard. This is a total fixation. And, of course, this is the kind of thing you read about all the time with people who get into trouble with sexual stuff and they say, well, I'm addicted to it. Well, yeah, that's the whole idea of sensuality. There's no control. It's just complete abandonment of the individual to this behavior. And it's happening all the time. Every week on our local television news stories, every week there is a story about some 60, 70-year-old man who has been caught sexually abusing some young girl or is involved in, you know, you got to think, what in the world's wrong with these old men? Well, it's an issue of sensuality or wantonness. It's a fixation that they are completely enslaved to. And Paul said that. And if you commit it, you're a slave to it. And that's where it goes. So that's the word sensuality. It's the idea that there's no control here. This is just an absolute fixation that cannot be denied. It's going to be indulged in every which way. So you have sexual misconduct, and then you have the death effect and impurity, and then you have the lack of control and sensuality. It's just running wild. And that brings us to the idolatry and sorcery thing, and you wonder, how does idolatry fit into this, and what is this sorcery thing, and how does it fit? Well, I struggle with that, but it's really interesting. In Romans chapter 1, when men refuse to acknowledge the God that he is, and turn themselves over to idols that aren't,
God gave them up in the lust of their bodies so that their bodies would be dishonored among themselves by their behavior. So the sexual misconduct was a direct outworking of God saying, you don't want to know the true God, you want to play like these other things are gods, then have at it. But this is what's going to happen. So idolatry is significantly linked into the sexual realm. And it's no accident that in Corinth and in many places in the New Testament culture, all of the temples of the idols had their own sexual perversions that were manifest. Temple prostitutes and the whole nine yards. And, you know, the perversion of sexual behavior. It was rampant in the culture of the first century, and it was tied to the theology. The idolatry is inherently the root of the sexual misconduct. And that brings us to sorcery. In Revelation 18, there is a litany of problems with this harlot, Babylon, mystery Babylon. And in chapter 18, there's a statement about how she's going to be destroyed and why. And it starts out by saying in verse 9, I believe, that the kings of the earth committed immorality with her. So sexual misconduct with her. And it goes down in the text somewhere around verse 23 and says why? Because she deceived them by her sorceries. In other words, she sucked them in with her sorceries, and the first rattle out of the cage is they're committing sexual sins with her. And for this cause, she's going to be totally destroyed by God with a great wrathful outpouring. So you say, well, okay, what is this sorceries thing? Well, the word is pharmakia. We get our word pharmacy from it. It has to do with the use of drugs. According to Revelation 18, verses 9 to 23, entire nations are brought to cataclysmic disaster by the use of drugs. Because it opens the whole issue of total deception up. And our culture was most clearly introduced to that with what? LSD? That was the beginning of the end. Mind-altering, it completely breaks down all of your inhibitions. And all of a sudden, anything goes, everything goes, doesn't matter because the drugs completely destroy your capacity for thoughtful reflection. You're deceived by the drug stuff. I don't think that it's legitimate to say that the use of drugs is always wrong because we have this medicinal thing about the body. And naturally, I have a vested interest in thinking that way. But you do have to be aware that there are certain drugs that are designed to mess with your mind. And you ought to be really leery of ever ingesting those because that's an open door for deception and it will produce sexual misconduct. It's automatic. It's no accident that free love and the drug culture were hand in hand in our culture. I really believe that the fact that Revelation says that entire nations are brought to this cataclysmic disaster explains why Paul's grocery list of the works of the flesh start with sexual misconduct that end up with the drug issue. Verse 19, the deeds of the flesh. There are no deeds of the flesh that are more manifest than a person's sexual behavior. That is clear. I mean, that makes a person's theological orientation as clear as it can. A person's physical body in his sexual expression is a statement of his theology. That's the opening of the deeds of the flesh are manifest. It's clear. You can't hide this. Well, you might try to hide it, but eventually the truth will come out. But the whole focus on the sexual stuff, I think, ends in the second word in verse 20 with the sorceries thing. From there, with enmity, strife, jealousy, and then you're getting into some another area that we'll get into next week. But the body, the misuse of the body, especially in sexual terms, starts with sexual misconduct. It ends with sorceries. And I think that Paul's grocery list here of looping it that way and having idolatry plugged in there is his way of saying that you can tell when somebody's theology is off by what they say about sexual behavior. You can tell what their theology is by what they say. Unless they're speaking lies, but sure enough, by what they do physically. So I really think that the order of the progression from sexual perversity to uncleanness to wantonness to idolatry to drug use is simply a progression that explains why Paul starts there. Sexual perversion, general term, goes to uncleanness, which is the lack of ability to promote or maintain health. It introduces the destructive downward spiral of health issues. From that, you go to lasciviousness or wantonness, which is a lack of moderation, a total fixation. From that, you go immediately to idolatry, which is defining God in terms of sexual behavior. And what is the bottom line in defining God as in terms of sexual stuff? Well, it's this. This is the essence of life. Idolatry is assigning to a false god the joy of life, the capacity to produce the joy of life. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. The end of 1 John is a statement. Don't assign the capacity to produce the joy of life to anyone other than God. And when a person says sex is the ultimate issue, that's idolatrous. It's automatic. You're defining God in terms of nervous excitement. And you go immediately from there to drug use, which is the last barrier of mental defense. It's systematically destroyed. So that now you're totally incapable of delivering yourself. It's hopeless, except for the intervention of grace. Paul says to the Corinthians, such were some of you. It's not hopeless. If God's allowed to come into the picture, but how are people going to allow God to come into the picture if the promoters of the picture are promoting a false picture by their own works of the flesh? That's Paul's issue here. Walk by the Spirit so that the testimony can be legitimate. The point is, it's no wonder that there is an enduring flame as the ultimate end of the deeds of the flesh in terms of the sexual misconduct. So what Paul is really driving at here is walking by the Spirit is the way to validate the truth of the gospel, and walking in the flesh is a total contradiction of everything that God intends in terms of good for men through what they believe. So if our behavior backs up our speech and it produces good for those who believe it, then it is from the Spirit of Christ dwelling in our bodies. If we allow a corrupt spirit to produce corrupt behavior, our mouths will speak the right words, but our behavior will be believed, not the words. So that's Paul's opening salvo. He said in verse 18, if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under law, you're free, you can live a life that's effective. And the way you decide whether you're living effectively is, okay, let's just look at what happens when you're not. These are the things that are going to crop up. I really believe that Paul gave the list of the deeds of the flesh in verses 19, 20, and 21, and through the Spirit in verses 22 and 23, as kind of like a barometer. Or something like that, where it's not so much, oh, I've got to keep myself from immorality. I've got to keep myself from impurity. I've got to keep myself from idolatry. If you can keep yourself from all that stuff, you don't need Jesus. The issue is, am I being led by the Spirit? Well, here's the works of the flesh. Are these being made? Is this what we're engaging in? If we are, then obviously we're not being led by the Spirit. We're walking in the flesh. What are you supposed to do in that case? confess it, turn to God, and seek His grace to overcome it, and then the testimony of the body will be legit. So I think that's really what's going on. Paul is really upset with the false brethren in Galatia because they're proclaiming a false gospel. But he's also upset with the reality of the body being a major testament to the truth of the theology of the individual who inhabits the body. Because what we believe is going to produce our future. So, we need to believe the truth. Well, how can we unless we see it in action? That's Paul's whole point. Questions or observations, comments?